Good afternoon and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we always say, this conversation includes you. And if you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. That first number is the number from Oahu, and from anywhere else, the 877-941-3689 will get you to us. So it's the last day of the ledge for 2016. Governor Ige gave lawmakers a B grade for their efforts this time around. Tonight, we'll see how our panel and you assess this session. HPR contributing editor Neil Milner is here. So is UH Public Policy Center Director Colin Moore. And they've got their report cards. The phone lines again are open for yours at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Welcome back, guys.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, so let's start talking about some of the things that happened this time around. Let's start with a big issue on everybody's mind coming into this: affordable housing.
Well, there wasn't a whole lot that was done with affordable housing in this session. I mean, there's a little more money that was appropriated to the regular affordable housing programs to help subsidize rental programs. But in terms of big issues, given that this is the number one issue when people are polled, what they care about, I mean, this really is the thing most citizens are concerned about. It's surprising that there was so little action.
So you're talking about the money that went into the dwelling unit revolving fund, the money that went into the rental housing assistance revolving fund, and then some other pieces of that.
Yes. This is one of those issues that I'm convinced the legislature can never solve. And by never solving, what I mean is that there has never been an indication that they can do more than just a little bit of a dent in it. And some people might say that's because of their lack of will. I would say something else. We can come back to that later when we do a more overview. But Colin is right. This is an enormous problem, and the steps that were taken were very incremental.
And you know, if I could just jump onto what Neil's saying, what's interesting to me about affordable housing is now how it becomes linked to so many other issues. I mean, we're going to talk in a minute, I'm sure, about the Airbnb controversy. But part of that controversy is fears that by allowing Airbnb, by legitimating it, we're actually going to increase rental prices here in Hawaii. And I know that was Senator Laura Thielen's point when that bill was moving through.
Yeah, people on the North Shore say that all the time.
All right, we're going to get to Airbnb in a second. But I want to talk to you about the fact that, you know, we didn't really see a whole lot going for people who are in low-income rentals so that they could have that tax credit. But what we did see was a little bit of incentivizing for the building or the encouragement of building. That's the SB 2833 to make low-income housing tax credits a little more valuable and to help developers find it a little more attractive to build low-income rentals.
Yes, I mean, I think within this kind of narrow frame, that's really important, given the fact that public housing, that affordable housing is not going to be built by the government anymore. It's just simply off the table. The best you can do is to give some kinds of incentives to the developers to do it. And what, of course, you're competing with there is a market in which you have to give the developers a fair amount in order for them to make money. So it's a real challenge. Just add that one item that disappeared from the housing thing, and that is affordable housing, where some of the legislators had introduced a bill in which there would be incentives to – you'd have incentives to move out of public housing, the remaining public housing, and there would be incentives to save money in order to build up the opportunity to buy a house later on. That bill disappeared, and I think the devil in that bill was the details, that it sounded good in principle, but in practice, the amount of money that you would need to incentivize it and that people would need to actually get into the housing market was probably too large to be feasible.
We did see some effort to try to contain more of effective interaction and coordination to create transit-oriented development. And we keep talking about that one over and over again. You talk about pulling them out of different neighborhoods, but to be able to put them where these transit stations are going to be, and that's still a happening thing, but not here yet.
Transit-oriented development is really an important issue here, and it's important in a kind of negative way from what we've seen, and it's important in a positive way. In a negative way, if you think about all of the challenges that rail has, one of the primary challenges is to be able to develop transit-oriented housing that brings railroad that brings ridership in, and it also is a way to create more diverse kinds of communities. That's really very far behind, except, say, in Kaka'ako, where the market takes care of it. The positive side was that this was David Ige's most visionary proposal that he introduced about closing down Old Triple C, relocating it, and developing a transit-oriented situation there, a community there, a diverse community. He calls it something like the New Kalihi. The legislature went, again, just a little step in that direction. They didn't really say much about transit-oriented development. They gave him some planning money to look to at study. Relocation yeah. to prison. Really not even that much, the development after that of that area.
All right, we got a couple callers on the line, unless you want to go first, Colin. Anything more about affordable housing that you had at top of your mind?
No, let's go to the callers.
All right, let's go to the callers. Aaron calling us from UH. Aloha, Aaron. Welcome to Town Square.
Yeah, good afternoon, and thank you for the conversation once again.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining it.
Great. So I wanted to give you an update sort of on the summation of the police reform bills we had touched on a couple weeks ago. And
good. Then we don't have to do it later. Go ahead.
That's right. So since all of the experts are there, we had had a conversation a couple months ago where we had said that priorities of the public had seemed that they weren't going to be real intense on police reform. But that did shift enough to let legislators get behind a new oversight mechanism. It's the first one that's been created in the state that oversees police. Since we can really go back to some of the counties creating their commissions. And so now that there's a bureaucracy, legislators have talked about next year creating a standards board or maybe expanding the shooting board from this year into a standards or a professional licensing board. And cameras will again be a high priority next year. They did not get through this year, but the citizens' right to videotape police did, and as we see around the country, those videotapes have been more effective at stemming negative police conduct or them not following policies. So two important ones, and then, of course, a backlog of sex assault kits. They produced funding to go ahead and clear those, so maybe we can go ahead and make sure that there's no predators in the community that we haven't detected, and also to go ahead and help the Attorney General and the county prosecutors clear some of those cases.
Aaron, I'm so glad you called. You just cleared off two of my columns.
Well, thank you for having this conversation. These are important. As you can see, they let the community galvanize and stand behind some of these important reform measures.
Great. Thanks very much for chiming in. We appreciate it. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open at 941-3689 if you call us from Oahu, or 877-941-3689. And before we go away from some of that, as Aaron brought up about, you know, police and prison reform, and certainly talk about the sex assault kits. Anything else either one of you would like to add to that?
Well, I think it's just important to emphasize that we're still the only state in the nation without a statewide training standards board. I think that's remarkable, and it seems like it's such an obvious thing for the legislature to pass. This has been around for a while, so they're always afraid to do anything brand new. I mean, they have to hear it 3 years in a row. But
that was sort of Aaron's point, that next year it's going to come
So maybe it will, and I'm hopeful that it will. But, I mean, I think I'm not exactly sure why we need so much more time to do this. If we're the only state that hasn't had one, it's been around for a while. Are they simply afraid of SHOPO? Are these electoral concerns? I'm really not sure.
Well, at the moment, we're out of time, so there's nothing that we're going to do for this year. But
well, the other thing that has to do with the this board that was set up, the supervisory board, that is a step forward because we didn't have anything like it. It's a board made up of appointees, most of whom are prosecutors or police officers. In fact, all of whom were going to be, and then they changed the bill. They investigate any kind of police-related death in custody or not in custody. But they can only recommend, they can only give their findings to the various prosecutors. It clearly was a compromise that there would have been an enormous amount of resistance on the part of the police and also probably on the part of prosecutors to move it away. The one other thing is that, yeah, they're now going to take a look at the rape kits. They're going to get through them, but the process may be fairly slow because the first thing that has to happen is the Attorney General has to give a report. And as soon as you say report, you're basically saying delay.
And yeah. We didn't talk about that before, but in stereo. Anyway, we'd like to hear from you. 941-368-9877, 941-3689, taking a look at the end of the legislative session and really how we would characterize it at this point. Going now to Paul, calling us from Maui. Aloha, Paul. Thanks for your patience. Welcome to Town Square. Hi there.
I think that the legislature has to get some courage, and it has to do three things. It has to implement rent control. This will solve the affordable housing problem. These are three solutions to the affordable housing problem. They have to implement rent control. They have to implement low-income tax credits for renters so that the renters can write off their rent from their taxes. And they also have to really police vacation rentals. They have to license them like we do here on Maui. We license them and we limit that, you know, their specific areas, and they put the numbers of areas out where there can be licensed vacation rentals. And once those all licenses are done, nobody gets to do vacation rentals anymore. And I'll take my discussion off the air on the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Paul. Okay, the first part about rent control, we've had a whole lot of discussions about that. I think you came and participated with one of those, Colin, a while back. But it doesn't look like that's a place where anybody is really willing to go. The second part of it, the tax credits for renters to be able to, you know, do what people who have mortgages do. You get to write off a percent of that, which is your interest. But that has been tried now for several years, and each time it's just gone down.
It sure has. And I think, I think it's shameful. I'll agree with the caller here that that to me shows a lack of courage in really dealing with this issue. Giving renters tax credits is standard practice in many high-rent states. I'm afraid that rent control has a pretty bad track record. It creates a lot of problems in the market. So I don't think we're going to see any rent control. But low-income tax credits is a very viable policy. As you said, Beth Ann, this gives renters, and there's a lot of renters here in Hawaii compared to other states in the nation, gives renters the same sort of tax benefits that people who own their homes have. And let's be clear, the mortgage interest deduction is one of the biggest middle-class subsidies around. And allowing renters to get some benefit from that is a very sensible policy. Why you can't have any action on that, I don't know. And I think we're going to talk about the other income inequality issues that were – many of which were proposed this session, from long-term care to paid family leave. They just can't get any traction. So I agree with the caller. He's right to be frustrated. I don't think our answer lies in rent control, but sure, a low-income renter tax credits.
Okay. And what about the part about – The vacation rentals. I mean, that's always the bane of a lot of people's existence, depending upon which neighborhood you're in. But just generally looking at what happened, that some of the big fight over that Airbnb bill.
Sure. And I think it boils down to this. The ledge would really like the tax revenue from Airbnb. And Airbnb says, well, we're not willing to, we'll leave the state if you make us conform to the same kind of standards that a normal rental property would have. I think at the end of the day, it just boils down to the fact that, you know, do we want to risk Airbnb leaving? Do we want to drag this out, or do we want the tax revenue immediately? I mean, this really was an Airbnb bill, and they got their bill.
The other thing is that the political emotion about the role that the vacation rentals plays in the affordable housing issue is much higher than the degree of data that we have on that subject. I mean, this would be, you know, we talk a lot, get cynical about study commissions and so on. But one of the things that I think would be really valuable would be to look at the effect that these things have on the market. It's easier to blame them because they're outsiders. A lot of the people who rent their houses, say, on the North Shore are rich. They own these houses. They never use them for anything else. But I think that's a really important issue, and it really hasn't received enough attention.
Is there an issue that you paid attention to this legislative session? How did it fare? And how would you grade lawmakers as we're now wrapping up the legislative session 2016? We'd like to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Neil Milner is here. Colin Moore is here, and you too, taking a look at the last day of the ledge. Now, okay, we talked a little bit about this sort of peripherally, but the water bill. You're going to talk about land, talk about ag, and what happens with land and development and all the rest of it. Well, you know, we've been talking about diversified ag now for a little while, and this bill that also caused a kerfuffle, but not nearly as much as the Airbnb bill, which was kind of interesting. Water rights bill that a lot of people believe, you know, favored Alexander and Baldwin, and that it might draw the most attention, did to a point, but yeah, there were protests, but the bill still passed, and we'll see what is going to happen once it gets to Governor Ige.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a fairly simple story about a complex issue of water rights and this historical battle that people have had over the water. The simple issue is this. The court ruled against A and B in regard to the allocation of water. A and B didn't like the decision, and they went to the legislature to try to, in effect, to get the decision overturned. And what the legislature did was to, in effect, give A and B the advantage of time. What the bill does is to give A and B 3 more years. Now, it's conceivable during that time that something can happen in the court, but time is on the side of the in the litigation, the folks who have the time, and of course the folks who have the money, which is A and B. So the simple story was the bill started out as not doing that, and then it ended up doing that. And I think you can conclude from that it had something to do with the influence that A and B had in it. And the people on the other side are angry because they didn't think that A and B deserved those 3 years because the court had ruled against them.
And there's one other thing, which is that now we're paying attention to it, this 3-year extension, but the legislature has a practice in the past of just cutting those limits later. I mean, it wouldn't be so hard for them to go back and say it's not just 3 years, it's in perpetuity.
How this bill came about and then how it morphed and changed over time, and the fact that A and B then said, okay, we're going to, you know, not restrict the flow to some of those or allow the flow to some of the East Maui of streams to now again flow through, that seemed to happen in an orchestrated sort of way. And then we look at all this. I know this is being very tongue-in-cheek about all of this. And yet, you know, there were people who were looking for some sort of, you know, precedent in all of this, didn't really get it. They just got the opportunity to take care of this within that 3-year period of time, which is to say, everything stays pretty much the same.
I'm shocked at your skepticism, Beth Ann.
I'm sure you are.
You don't think Alexander and Baldwin just they woke up one morning?
You know, here's the way things. You know, if you have two parties and you're trying to satisfy two parties, and you actually have some kind of regular conflict resolution with parties equal on each side, you would maybe work out something like that where each party would be relatively satisfied, and so the people who wanted the water would be satisfied because. But what seemed to happen here, it did seem to be pretty well orchestrated. A and B said, well, if we're going to get this, sure, we'll allow some of that water to be used. But the fundamental thing is that they still are, for the next 3 years, they still don't have to make a fundamental change in the water thing. So, you know, A and B did something there. It was a reasonably nice gesture, although people say it's not enough. But we shouldn't sugarcoat this process, as you so cynically suggested.
Well, you know, and one more thing that's somewhat curious about this is, of course, there were protesters. Mm-hmm. I mean, the taro farmers on Maui, but it didn't really rise to the level that you could imagine it could becoming controversial. I mean, the optics of this thing, one of the old Big Five versus Maui taro farmers. There were protests, but it wasn't like Mauna Kea. I mean, this didn't become one of the central hot button issues, and you could imagine that it could have become that.
It could have become, and then there's the whole other story that we haven't really talked about very much, is the fact that if all that land is going to find another purpose, well, it's going to need water, and those farmers are really going to need to be able to have access to that if we're going to really have some diversified ag plots happening with all of that, or, you know, smaller farms, so that there may be a very good reason for that. And that doesn't necessarily make those who would like to see it not happening feel any better, but then again, what's going to happen with that land is still up in the air.
Well, protests are hard to organize. You can have a bunch of people who are upset but are scattered around and are busy folks and are not necessarily going to come together to do the sorts of things that you would need, say, for TMT. Think about how exceptional protests are here rather than how much the rule they are, and that gives you some idea.
All right, we're going to go to the phones. If you'd like to join us, You can call us at 941-3689 if you're on Oahu. And from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. That number also works if you're listening to the live stream from someplace else and you want to weigh in on our legislature's last day and what happened this session. Going now to Lauren calling us from Palolo. Aloha, Lauren. Welcome to Town Square, and thanks again for your patience.
Aloha. Thank you for having me. Yeah, I wanted to actually go back and address the affordable housing, and actually kind of tagged along with what you were just talking about with all this ag land now becoming available. And it has to do with, you know, we're seeing obviously a lot of folks starting to buy second, third homes that are coming from the mainland or overseas. And I'm wondering if there has been anyone who's thought about entertaining the idea of, you know, imposing some kind of tax if it's, you know, not your primary home, and you know, having that go into a funding pool to help kind of either drive solutions for affordable housing, like through committee or what have you, or go towards infrastructure, other things that, you know, we're needing to put in. And the second part to that is, you know, especially with some of these ag lands being sold and turned into gentleman farms, you know, how can we try to disincentivize those activities, and maybe just food for thought for the next legislative season, or if anyone else has kind of brought these issues to attention.
Well, some of them in terms of the A and B land, not really talking about gentleman farms, but really talking about leasing parcels to farmers who would do a variety of things, any, you know, suggested from food that we need here or to be able to have grasslands for grazing,
no,
being able
yeah,
to finish.
Absolutely.
So not necessarily that.
Folks are turning ag lands into gentleman farms, mm-hmm. and they're not actually, they might be putting up, you know, some hobby farm, fruit trees, but it's not really their primary business is the concern.
All right, let's take your first part, and then we'll deal with the other one. Thanks very much for the call, Lauren. Looking at the idea of second homes and a tax on that, first of all, you know, that's a city issue.
I guess it's a city issue. That's right, because it would be property tax. I don't know enough about the tax system to know if there is a way that it could be done at the state level. But the fact of the matter is that is something that other jurisdictions do in the rest of the United States. It's constitutionally impossible to prevent people from buying houses that way, to keep outsiders out. But you certainly can tax them for if it's a second home. And you can also, other places, tax homes that have views. If you have a view that's exceptional, you'll get a higher property tax thing. And so, yeah.
But doesn't, I mean, don't we all, who if you own your own home, you get your owner's exemption, which
yes.
in effect is very different than if you,
yes.
you own it and live in it, as opposed to someone who has a second home there. So we do, in fact,
you do have
something
right now.
Structure.
Exactly. You do have something right
but
now.
But there's been, I mean, Eric Pape, I think, in Civil Beat has done mm-hmm. the most extensive study of this. I mean, there are ways to tinker with the city
yes.
property tax laws to make more of a direct impact on second home ownership. I mean, to push the tax burden over there, to change some of the tax incentives such that it really is in your interest to rent directly to someone who lives on Oahu as opposed to reserving that for vacation rentals. And I think this is a larger theme, which is really, I mean, Neil's right. This is solving the affordable housing crisis is, you know, in a very quick way is impossible. But there is sometimes a lack of creativity and really working more closely to study what sorts of property tax laws would put a dent into this would be an important step. And
would go to the city.
Oh, that would go to the city. Yes. That's right. And we're mainly talking about the state today. But it's part of a larger theme, which is...
And maybe we'll do a show just on that larger theme.
I just want to add one thing. And again, I think when we talk broader themes later, we'll come back to it. This is a legislature that is 90-some percent Democratic, and at least by reputation, a relatively liberal body. We'll talk about that later. There are places that have far and the kind of conservative defense of property here is not nearly as great publicly as it is somewhere else. You don't have a large conservative movement. Yet these kinds of things, these kinds of creative ways to deal with some kind of property issues that are well within, let's say, the left of center, if not the center itself, just go by the board. The legislature becomes very conventional about these sorts of things. And I think, in a sense, tarnishes the reputation that it has for being progressive.
Anything that either one of you wants to say about the gentleman farm issue? Any other ag law?
Well, if they would enforce the law, that's one way. And if they didn't allow, if they didn't have that Keystone Cops mix-up between this, the city and county and the state in regard to how you enforce, who can actually go in and say, you're wrong, get the heck out of here, that they have in that outrageous Cunha thing. A lot of it is about people obviously getting away with stuff. And one of the reasons that you get away with stuff, and this is as much a city and county issue, is the city and county doesn't have either the will or the resources to monitor some of these things. It's another example of the role that monitoring has to play in it and the need that you for putting resources into seeing what's going wrong. So I'm not saying that, you couldn't tinker with the legislation, but a lot of this stuff, you know, you take a ride to some of these gentleman farming areas out here, and they don't look much like farms to me. That one that overlooks Haleiwa up on that ridge, I don't know what they're growing there.
Well, one thing we know that we may be growing in Hawaii is hemp.
Yes, hemp.
Yes, and a lot of people, including Cynthia Thielen, with their, you know, hemp hooray. Finally, after all these years, now it's moving on a little bit more. So,
well, congratulations to Cynthia Thielen. She's been working on this for 20 years. I think great. I mean, this is I don't think industrial hemp is going to be the savior for us, but I see no reason why this shouldn't be passed and we shouldn't be happy about it. And it's good to see that a Republican can get something through the ledge.
I agree.
We're gonna move on then. Go to Daniel calling us from Kapahulu. If you'd like to be next, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're taking a look at the end of the ledge. What's on your list? Aloha, Daniel.
Yeah. Hi. Hi, everybody. Thank you. I just want to say I'm a pedestrian. I've ridden my bike around. I'm on the street. We live right on the street, so we get a lot of street noise. It's just because, hey, the rent's cheap. But I used to ride a moped. I used to get around on a moped and honestly, you know, didn't wear a helmet. I got away with it. I was very defensive. I was a good, you know, respectful driver. I'm alive because of it. But I don't appreciate the really extreme noise of the souped up mopeds. And, you know, I admit I was lazy. I was apathetic. I didn't call my legislatures to see about the moped bill. And honestly, a few days have passed. I haven't read anything about it in the newspaper. What happened with that?
It's a city and county issue, right? That's what happened with it. The city and county, that's the reason. And you can, they've been dickering with this one for a while.
My kid had his first moped. Kid.
I want to say that as a former bike rider commuter for many years, that you're living on and riding on Kapahulu and living to tell about it is an awesome thing. That's the worst street for bicycling or for mopeding that there is in urban Honolulu.
But you know, Daniel's. Call.
Lanes, though,
go, what?
And that makes it okay. I was when it comes to biking, I stay on the sidewalk. I don't.
Yeah.
I would never ride on a regular street lane, really, in Kapahulu unless it's about 3 o'clock in the morning, and then even I'd be real careful. Yeah.
Which is not what we are told we're supposed to do with either bikes or mopeds. But Daniel, thanks very much for the call. You know, but the thing is, listening to Lauren a moment ago, we know there's a lot of confusion as to who has jurisdiction over what and what place is the appropriate place to go looking for some sort of redress, whether it's because of taxes or whether it's, you know, taxing second homes or taking a look at what happens when you're in a very noisy area with very noisy mopeds.
Well, if you want to make it more complex, the actually it's an interesting constitutional issue because the state could probably do legally any of these things if it wanted to. And I'm not saying it should. I'm saying if it wanted to, because a city is a creation of a state, and the state can really fundamentally change. That's what a lot of issues get down to when they become political issues about who should do it. But if the state wanted to regulate noise, it could certainly do it.
And part of the understanding is, I mean, part of this is a very understandable confusion given that the whole island is the yes. city and the county, and nearly, you know, most people in the state of Hawaii live on this island in the city and county of Honolulu. And the state of Hawaii, of course, does things that most other states do, like centrally run the entire educational system. So it really is a confusing overlap of boundaries and responsibilities.
So like little Venn diagrams where you have places where they intersect a whole lot and you're not sure who's really going to have the responsibility.
Even for us trained professionals.
So speaketh Milner. What do you have to say about this session? 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, call that number. If you're calling us from the neighbor islands, call us at 877-941-3689. An issue that you and I talked about early in the session, Colin, was paid family leave. And this year, now there's going to be some money for a commission to study it, but not necessarily as far as you would have liked to see it go.
No, I mean, and I think this is one of these cases where the legislature likes to hear things 3 years in a row. Long-term care was proposed last year. Again, this year it died. And paid family leave had the same fate. And, you know, this was presumably because they didn't want to, I think in the case of long-term care, increase the excise tax. And with paid family leave, I think it just was new and unfamiliar, even though this has been underway in California and some other states for quite some time. So I'm hopeful this will be one of these issues that comes up a few more times and eventually we get it. But this goes back to something that Neil was saying earlier and I agree with, which is that one thing I can say about the legislative session this year and maybe the last few years is just the lack of creativity. We think of ourselves as a progressive state. I'm not sure we are. I mean, the days when Hawaii was really a leader in public policy issues, when we had a legislature that was willing to take some risks, the days of Governor Burns are long past, and now we have a group of relatively comfortable upper-middle-class professionals who are happy to work around the margins, but more or less don't ever stick their neck out there, get themselves reelected every time, and people are frustrated because these issues that really do affect them, the ledge doesn't seem to deal with them aggressively ever, and they're happy to kick the can down year after year until eventually, you know, they're satisfied, they've heard it enough times, they can move on it. But the sense that we should be a leader on any issue seems to be absent.
I want to ask you, though, about the DHHL bill, because we've been talking about a lot of issues concerning land, and that's been such a long-standing, rancorous issue, and the issue of really how much is sufficient funding. And certainly, you know, $11 million, $17 million, what does it need to be? Well, they got the $11 million now. But what do you see happening with this case?
Well, I think it's going to come down to the fact that, you know, what is adequate? I mean, the court seemed to think it was $28 million. Certainly, Representative Ward has been one of the biggest friends of DHHL. He almost got himself kicked out.
Because he pointed to the Queen.
Yes,
to the statue of the Queen. Who knew that was a violation of legislative protocol?
Exactly, exactly.
I thought it was the word.
No.
That was, well, yeah, you can say that word because it isn't that word.
No, it's not. And then he said the cheapskate might have been a better word.
That's right. But if you read the full story, it turns out that the vice speaker at the time was in the chair, and he upbraided Gene Ward, who's not exactly a Donald Trump demagogue, for not addressing face forward, but for pointing to the statue of Queen Liliuokalani somewhere out there.
And,
I digress.
I think Ward has a point, and I'm not sure the court is going to be satisfied with this appropriation. I mean, it's a separation of powers issue. Can the court order a certain appropriation? What is sufficient funding? And by cutting $11 million from the recommended amount, we might hear from the court again. It's unclear. And part of the issue might be how much political pressure can be put on the court to leave the ledge alone.
You know, it's interesting. If you look at the history nationally of these kinds of battles about whether the courts can tell the legislature how much to spend, they tend to involve marginalized groups, politically marginalized groups that really need money. in the 70s and the 80s, there were terrific court fights because the courts would say to the legislature, your mental health facilities are awful, or what used to be called mental retardation facilities are awful. You have to put in X amount of money. And the legislators would fight this, saying it's a constitutional question. It's a separation of powers question, which, of course, it is. But deep down, it's a money question. They don't want to allocate that kind of money. So you have a similar situation here, where a group that is a very vulnerable group, the Hawaiians through the DHHL, essentially getting a court decision that says the Constitution requires an adequate amount of money, and I as a judge am saying it's not an adequate amount of money. So what the legislature is essentially saying is two things. The constitutional question is we get to decide, but the real economic and political issue is that what they decided is less than half of what the judge was. So whether it goes to court or not, you always have to keep your eye on the main chance here, which is about money, whatever the constitutional issue.
Which means it's going to end up costing us more.
Well, there's going to be some delay here. I don't know if it'll end up costing us more in the sense that the court will rule against the legislature, because the courts don't like to do that. So that I don't know how this will end, but I doubt if it's going to end now, because I think the litigants who won the first case are going to go back to the court and say this is not enough money.
But we often see in cases where nothing really happens until it's litigated.
Oh, yeah.
And so then you get policy by litigation.
If you get it at all, yeah. Sure. Oh, yeah. But the longer – the other thing is that it may take forever. The ceded land issues, some of these others, mm-hmm. just go on and on.
If you would like to go on and on with us, you can. 941-3689 is our number if you call us from Oahu, and from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. It's the last day of the legislative session for this year, taking a look at what passed, what didn't, what's probably going to come back for next year, and what all that says about the character of this legislature. Give us a call with your perspective, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. A bill that sort of took everybody by surprise, certainly a lot of people who are in the legislature, was that geothermal bill that came kind of veritably empty. It died in conference, but there were a lot of people who were wondering, you know, how could even this happen? And some lawmakers who said as much.
Don't ask me. I mean, really, if you send in a blank bill, what are we supposed to know? And what we can tell from it is that it appears as if the House was having trouble figuring out how to go forward with this. And rather than waste a lot of time coming up with something, they thought, well, we're just going to have to fight this again in the conference committee, because we're not going to come anywhere close anyway. Let's just send a bill. Those of you who are taking courses right now, don't try this with your term paper. Don't tell your teacher that I'm not sure what I want to do, but I'm going to turn in a blank piece of paper and we'll work something out together.
Well, I mean, in theory, somebody could have used that kind of rationale for any bill.
Well, it has.
I can't agree.
You know,
so
it's intriguing to me why they picked this bill out, why they decided to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it didn't get anywhere because, for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that it offended some of the senators, saying you didn't do your homework.
But while we're on the subject of energy, that House bill that required the DOE to set the goal of becoming net zero in energy use by 2035, that one passed. But that, again, is to have a goal, not to say this is, you know, what we will do and this is how we're going to do it.
You know, this, I think this is a product of some of the younger, more progressive legislators, people like Takashi Ono, who really people like Chris Lee, who've really pushed to think through the environmental impact of all of these things through any legislation. And they saw an impact. I mean, so I think this was good policy. I mean, it's not going to require anything, but it does set a goal. It does, make the DOE more conscious of how they're going to implement this $100 million worth of air conditioning. So that's all to the good. But the $100 million for air conditioning, I mean, this is considered one of the great victories of the session this year. It's I think counts in the EGE column. This is something that he wanted. He wanted to fund it in a different way through the Green Energy Market Securitization Fund. Most likely that probably was illegal. I mean, it probably would have come back to the state through the courts.
But now they got Medicaid money.
But they did get Medicaid money. And the curious thing to me is how this victory has been framed. I mean, so the state got about $170 million in Medicaid and some other federal money to reimburse the state. Mm-hmm. And yet the way the media has framed this, or I think some of the members of the legislature, Jill Takuda and Sylvia Luke in particular, was that this money was found, that this was one of the great, you know, through the process of legislation, the $100 million to fund air conditioning was somehow found or dropped off by Hawaii's fairy godmother. In fact, this is just money that came back from the federal government.
But more than they were expecting.
More than they were expecting. They could have spent this money on anything. They could have spent it to further pay down unfunded liabilities. And they chose to spend the money on air conditioning. That doesn't mean it was inappropriate expenditure. I mean, I think we should air condition our classrooms too. But the idea that this was somehow the result of some creative bit of legislative maneuvering, I think, is just nonsense.
Going to go now to one of our other callers. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Wiley, calling us from Kamuela. Aloha.
Hi.
Welcome to Town Square.
Hello, just a simple question. Did the ivory ban bill pass?
Yes, it did.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
You're very, very welcome.
Very relief. Thank you.
There you go. That was a quick one. Maybe you don't have such a quick one. You can call us and ask a bigger question or a larger question or talk about some of the issues you were following this legislative session. Again, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Okay, so we talked about the AC. But something before we leave some of the things we were talking about with the state, what about that cap on the continuous 89-day temp hires as emergency hires that just kind of were moving round and round and round, and now there's a cap?
Yeah, that's one of those issues that the public really doesn't pay much attention to, but is a pretty significant issue within the state bureaucracies. The 89-day cap is called an emergency hire. And the reason that it was originally put in is that for emergency hires, if you needed someone for a short-term job and you could hire them fantastically easily compared to the way HR generally works or other hiring processes, they could only work for 89 days. And the assumption was after that they would be through and they don't get some of the same benefits. What's happened over the years historically at the university and elsewhere is that it becomes a workaround, that it's a way to get somebody on board that you really need. And I don't mean necessarily in a kind of Darth Vader sort of way. People need to get someone in, someone to do secretarial work. It's going to take forever to try to bring them on other ways. You bring them on for three months. Who wants to get rid of a good worker after 89 days? You renew it. And so the custom, as opposed to the law, began to allow it to do that. So getting rid of it is good administration in a kind of ethereal sense.
But practically?
Practically, well, you see a number of the state bureaucracies object to getting rid of it, and they're very candid why. And in a perfect world, you would use it for just short-term things, just like in a perfect world, unemployment compensation would be what it was originally supposed to be, which was a short-term thing. We don't live in a perfect world in regard to unemployment. We don't live in a perfect world in regard to bureaucracy. So I'm sympathetic to the state bureaucracies and wanting to keep the law, but they're actually going to get rid of it. They passed. You watch and see if there aren't creative ways that they're going to get around that.
That's exactly right. Anyone who's worked for the state of Hawaii realizes
that would be the two of us
realizes that it can take 6 months sometimes to replace a position. And so people use these 89-day appointments to keep the machinery of government humming. So what happens now that you can't use this? I mean, this to me is symptomatic of a larger problem that doesn't ever seem to get as much attention as it should, which is that our state procurement rules and civil service rules and collective bargaining rules, as well intentioned as they probably were, have made it almost impossible to get anything done. I mean, I'll give you the classic example here is the emergency proclamation for homelessness, right? Homelessness is not is not a storm that somehow arrived. It's been around for a long time. Why do we need an emergency proclamation? So we can actually get something done, so we can wade through some of these rules and regulations. And the 89-day appointments is a similar thing. It's just a fix. And what we really need to do is go back and reevaluate some of these rules, which aren't really protecting or helping anyone at this point.
All right, we're going to take a few more callers. If you want to join us, call us soon, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 with the issue or issues you followed this session and how you feel about how the session wound up. Sharon calling from Maui. Aloha, Sharon. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was calling about the timeline on the air conditioning in the school system. And the reason I'm calling is because I am a teacher and I teach 17-year-olds and I have between 25 and 30 students in a class. And we measured the DOE came in and put a thermometer in my room that read 93 degrees for about 2 months in a row. And today, in fact, it was 89 degrees. So I was just kind of wondering if there is a timeline for that. And it kind of made it very difficult for the kids during the year. And you were just talking about how long the bureaucracy does take. So that's kind of my question.
All right, Sharon, let me get you an answer.
To actually make it tolerable for my kids.
All right. And I hear you and feel for you in a room that hot with all those kids.
Sharon, I have good news and bad news for you. The good news is that there is indeed a timeline. The timeline is roughly a year, I believe, 2017. The bad news is not going to surprise you because you're working for the DOE as a teacher for a long time. In order for it to happen in 2017, the process has to be implemented. That is that certain you have to make the room ready for it. There's going to be the need to kind of do the maybe minor repairs of windows to keep leaks out, all these little kinds of things that involve maintenance and repair. So when I say you've worked around the DOE and the state long enough, you know that those things don't always happen anywhere close to what they're supposed to. So that's what you have to watch out for.
All right, while we're sort of on an educational bent here, let's talk about some other things that happened in education. Okay, so the UH Cancer Center, transitional dollars, that's not going to be happening?
Guess not. Nope.
Okay, how about the UH Athletics Media Center, that $35 million?
Oh, that's not an athletics media center, is it?
No. Sorry, it's a general media center.
Center.
You're thinking of the $6 million that was originally proposed to come out of. Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Not going to happen. Okay. But Kihei High School.
Kihei High School is going to happen. Well, the Kihei, that's a whole different dynamic, high schools as opposed to the university. Kihei High School is going to happen. Campbell High School is not going to happen. Some of the legislators out in Kapolei are, especially Bob McDermott, is really livid, saying we need it more than Kihei needs a Patsy Mink High School, which I guess is what it's going to be called. You can understand, if you look at the numbers, why McDermott is so upset, because Campbell High School, which, by the way, has come a long way in the last few years, is nonetheless very overcrowded, the largest high school. But if you look at the other side, you know, it's about getting in line to some extent, but it's more than that. What the state already has a process ready to pay for that. That money wouldn't go there, and they gave the Campbell enough money to put up one room, which they claim is all the DOE could do in a year anyway.
All right, but you got a lot of little kids who are going to be happy because there's a $10 million appropriation for the Open Doors.
Yes, that's right. The state has clearly decided that if it's going to have anything close to universal pre-K, it's not going to do it the way Governor Abercrombie wanted to do it, which is more or less in one fell swoop with a constitutional amendment that will also sorts of stuff. It's going to be done incrementally, and it does increase, but we still are a low percentage compared to other states.
All right, let's get through some health things. We had a lot of people who are asking periodically about what was going on with psychologists and the prescriptive authority, and that again failed this year. We did see some medical marijuana law reform that was just talked about earlier this week. And then again, there were the issues with the state hospital. So let's talk about the state hospital and also Wahiawa General and then the Hawaii Health Systems Corporation that also saw an appropriation for the transfer, especially for Maui Hospital.
So that's a big list. So maybe we'll talk about the psychologist prescription authority, because that was one of the most controversial of the three. Look, the state is very cautious when it comes to extending certain rights to what we might call the allied medical professionals, and psychologists here their ability to prescribe drugs came under that caution. I mean, Richard Cregan, who's a doctor on the Big Island, led the fight against this. The claim is that psychologists don't have the same sort of training. Some of them might get their degrees online. I don't know how much of that was fear-mongering, how much of it was true. There was, however, I will give Cregan credit for making this point, which is that it's not clear that what this bill is designed for, which is to increase mental health access to people on neighbor islands, will actually work. What happens when you give psychologists prescribing authority? Do they just move to Honolulu? Do they stay in rural districts? Is there really a need for this? Or can you solve it in another way? I am actually somewhat sympathetic to that argument that it's not clear that this is really going to solve the problem we think it's going to solve, that there are some other possibilities for abuse. And so in this case, I may disagree with Neil on this, I'm actually happy to see this bill killed.
No, I don't have anything to add other than it's been killed repeatedly. And there's some people express optimism that it's going to change, but I don't see any reason why this pattern is going to change.
All right, in the interest of time, but looking at the Hawaii State Hospital that got $160 million.
Yeah, that's really good news because, one, the state hospital has been abominable for a long time. In fact, for a long time, it was constitutionally abominable. We had a consent decree. If you talk to people who worked out there over the past few years, both publicly and privately, they were really saying it's a terrible place to work because forensic patients, that is, people with mental illness who should be in a more incarcerated setting, will get thrown in with the rest of the population, and this will change that.
While we're talking health, the CARE Act, that AARP and a whole coalition of caregiving associations had been trying to push through for 3 years, finally made it through this year, giving the opportunity for a patient to designate a caregiver and then the opportunity to have that person to be trained. All of this offering the opportunity, maybe
that's
not
right,
as stiff as they want it, but at least they got something through in there that they've been trying to do for a very, very long time.
Well, and the word opportunity there, Beth Ann, is key. The hospital objection was that they didn't have the facilities or the staff
or that they would be mandated.
If they were mandated, they wouldn't be able to do it. So they're not mandated, but it will give, as you suggest, people who leave the hospital, their caregivers, the opportunity to get trained. Whether how much of that training the hospitals actually do is an open question, but I think the AARP can call this a victory, even though, you know, really it's part of a larger compromise.
All right, we're going to go to Kalani calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Kalani. Welcome
Aloha.
To Town Square.
You know, I just had a comment about the Bill 2501, the water bill. You know, time and again we see in these politicians who are lobbied by these corporations, this particular one, A and B, in getting a special interest bill, kind of circumvent court decisions. But that's just my opinion about it. But the part that I quite don't understand is when they're voting yes with reservations, you would assume that if you have a reservation about a bill, you either wouldn't vote for it, you either vote no, or you wouldn't vote or abstain from it. But I just want you guys' comments about this vote.
Yeah. Okay. We'll do that for you quickly. So agreement on a continuum of yes or no, or just have... he makes a point. People read that and ask that question a lot.
It means yes, right? Yeah. I mean, when the rubber hits the road, it means yes.
The city council, they
use a Hawaiian word to dress it up, but it's along the same lines.
All right. We're going to go now to Sonia calling us from Pa'oa. Aloha, Sonia. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. Thank you. I was calling because I'd like to highlight House Bill 2169. So that's passed and is on its way to the governor, and it's allowing for a different kind of supervision for social workers. So I'm the director of the National Association of Social Workers, and we're excited because it's going to offer social workers to have the opportunity to have some of their supervision for their clinical experience done via telemedicine, so kind of a HIPAA-compliant version of video conferencing, and not just face-to-face. So we're excited about this because it opens up the ability to get supervision, which currently is difficult as you're working towards your 2 years of supervision post your master's. And especially we had a big push from our neighbor island members, neighbor island social workers, who are having trouble getting that supervision. So it means better access to mental health care in the long run because we can access supervision on neighbor islands and rural communities.
So this would allow them to do internships through telemedicine? Is that what it is?
Okay. So our 2 years, our postmasters, our internship
yes.
can be either now face-to-face or via telemedicine, and they DCCA currently had an agency setting wording, but no definition, and that's now cleaned up. So now supervision can also take place at a private practice setting.
All right. Well, we hear the excitement in your voice, and good for you. Glad that one went through, and it will have a meaningful impact on your life and others who are studying. Thanks so much. We're coming down to the last part of the hour, and I want to just sort of talk to you a little bit about how you would characterize this session. I mean, we talked about a lot of issues as we wove them into others, because some of these things, issues of affordable housing and homelessness and healthcare, all those things that weave together. With all of the talk that we had coming into this session about homelessness, do you feel that that actually showed up in what happened this session? I know, I mean, the governor got a lot more money for direct services for homeless programs, that $12 million more than had been requested to help homeless families and folks move into temporary and permanent housing. Some other things that didn't exactly go through, but we talked about the revolving funds earlier. But just in general, did we do as well as maybe all the conversation would have led us to believe we would?
You know, I think we did reasonably well on homelessness. I mean, I think in part people's frustration came from their sense that nobody was talking about this. Nobody was seriously tackling the problem. And the governor has clearly shown by his several emergency extensions of his emergency proclamations that he's serious. The ledge seems to be willing, which is very rare, to give this $12 million unencumbered, which in some ways either is a result of their trust in IGAE or their recognition that this is such a complex problem, which of course it is, that they really can't micromanage this process. And so, I mean, in that way, it's hopeful.
Neil?
I think I agree with Colin. I think that we have to remember two things, that this is a very long-term problem, whatever people think, and that it is possible that the homelessness will keep increasing because a lot of it has to do with the inability to be able to pay for housing. So we really have to be patient, and I agree with about the $12 million. I think that the way the city and county handle it has not been very good, because it's been full of rancor and full of
emotion
and full of a kind of bad politics. And the only thing that I'm concerned about that I think they could have maybe moved quicker on is Housing First. That Housing First seems to be a program that works pretty well. And the state keeps running into problems with making making things work. They try to develop a building for housing and something happens there. That is a little bit too much of the same old problems that the state has. But I given it the intractability, the semi-intractability of the problem, I think they're doing okay.
Now, obviously, there's so many more bills with opening between 2,600 bills, 2,700 bills we're not going to get through. But one thing that has been a thorn in our side and was going to continue to be unfunded liabilities. Did we do well this time on it by being able to increase it above the level at which we have been funding the unfunded liabilities?
Sure, I'll give them credit for that. I'll give them credit for putting $150 million in the rainy day fund. I mean, probably we should be funding these unfunded liabilities at 100%. That is what the agencies are required to fund them.
But we did 80%.
But we did 80%, which isn't bad. I mean, it's important to remember when people talk about these, the real crisis is in health care for retirees, not the pension system itself.
Now, before we say goodbye, anything that we didn't talk about that you think you really want to be able to put a period to the end of this sentence for this particular session?
Well, the question is, what effect is Governor IGAE having? And is this, can we count this as a victory for him? Was it a defeat? I'm not sure. Maybe neither. I mean, his really innovative policy was the redevelopment of Kalihi and the move for OCCC to Halava. He didn't get that. He didn't get his proposed tax increase for gas taxes for vehicle registration, which was going to go to transportation. So, I mean, I give the governor's influence kind of a B.
Which is kind of what he gave the legislature too, or what he gave the legislature. Go ahead.
I would say about the same thing for the governor, but I think there's a bigger issue about what this shows. This really shows the fundamental way that the legislature and the governor think about things. They would see it as a remarkably good session for these fiscal movements that they made that are important. But to go beyond that, to look at other questions involving inequality, to tackle affordable housing more, to really be able to make a dent into what it's like, the downside of what it's like living here, is not something that is really on the agenda anymore.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. Neil Milner, Colin Moore, we'll tackle it again sometime very soon when we blink. And thanks to all of you for joining us tonight for Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Have yourselves a good evening. Aloha.